Hello everyone, and welcome to this fourth episode of the History and Stuff podcast. I hope you enjoyed the earlier three episodes. They were a lot of fun to make. And today I decided to do something a little bit different. So I put up a poll on Twitter, as many of you probably saw. And the winning vote for today was the Ghana Empire, or Ouagadou Empire. So that will be the main topic of today's podcast. And I'd like to thank everyone who voted. And if you didn't vote, hello anyway, and nice to have you here. And if you have any suggestions for future topics, just hit me up in my DMs or on a comment on Twitter. My at is MrMoth7. And if you'd like to suggest a guest or would like to be a guest yourself, I would happily take these suggestions. So before we get into today's main topic, I hope you will indulge the language nerd in me for just a little bit to talk about the concept of history, because I think that's very important when we talk about especially African and history that is not Eurocentric, so to speak. Because in a lot of areas outside Europe and outside China and outside the Arab world and outside areas that have written languages a long time back and has a lot of written sources, a lot of areas outside of that has been very excluded from the writing of history. Because for a very long time, history was considered to be something you did with written sources, and anything that wasn't written sources just wasn't part of history. It was part of some other field, and maybe archaeology. This means the cultures that used oral tradition mostly, or which used languages that we can't decipher, or that had written sources but used perishable materials, a lot of those traditions have disappeared from today's history writing. One of these examples is the Harappa civilization, also known as the Indus Valley civilization, which was a very advanced civilization for its time, and it had things like running water and sewage systems back 4,000 years before Christ. But one of the things that they didn't have was a language that we understand. So they had hieroglyphs, but we can't understand them, even until this day. So everything we know about them comes from archaeology, and it's difficult to know that much more because we can't decipher their hieroglyphs. So even if archaeological digs can give us some information about these cultures that have been on the outside of the history writing, a lot of the sources we do have come from secondhand sources, such as foreign visitors or maybe even colonizers. So this may distort our image of these people, since we don't really have the stories the people had about themselves. One example of this is the description of religions, which tended to describe the religions in a way that their audience would understand. You see this, for example, in Greek sources, when descriptions of foreign religions tend to look quite similar to the Greek mythos, because if they made it a little bit more similar, it was easier for the audience to understand, even if it may not actually have been that similar. And I wanted to highlight this because the area we talk about today, which is Ghana or Ouagadou, has been pretty much overlooked throughout history writing. And it's important to note that these distortions we talk about don't only come from colonial sources, but they also come from the neighboring peoples, the rivals of the people, or trading partners. Because today we tend to think of Africa as sort of one thing. That wasn't really the case back in the time we're talking about today. So the neighboring peoples might not have seen each other as more similar than they were to the Europeans. There wasn't like an African identity, so I think that's easy, an important thing to keep in mind. So The area we're talking about today is called the Empire of Ghana, or Ouagadou, and it shouldn't be confused with today's country, which is called Ghana, which isn't actually in the area that the ancient Empire of Ghana was. It's a little more south and southeast. And I will call the country Ouagadou, mostly, because it's a little less confusing since there is a country today called Ghana, as well as because Ouagadou was actually the name they had for their own country. Ghana was actually the name of the ruler, as well as the name of the country given by visitors, mainly Arab visitors. So, on to the main topic of today. We start our journey in the geographical region of Africa called Sudan, which is not the country of Sudan, but it is an area of West Africa, which is slightly south of Sahara. It's also sometimes called the Sahel, which means the border of Sahara, which has a very arid climate, and it's very dry and very, very difficult to have agriculture that works very well. And one of the reasons that this empire grows from there is that they had very advanced agriculture for the time, and they were able to grow a lot of crops. The people we're talking about today were called the Sononike, and they had a language that was also called Sononike. The main period of the Empire of Ouagadou was in around 800 to 1080, although the state existed before that. The sort of main period, the time of great expansion, was 800 to 1080. The kingdom of Ouagadou tended to expand militarily a lot, and they conquered a lot of areas inhabited by Berbers as well. So they were themselves sub-Saharan Africans, but they also conquered areas where Tuaregs, for example, lived. And they're indigenous Saharan peoples that lived in oases and things like that. And a lot of Berbers still live in the area of Sahara, even today. Yes, and the position of the Ghana, or the king, was very central to the society. And a lot of religious ceremonies reflect this, that the king was the real center of it all. It was a very centralized system. And the line of succession was also kind of uncommon for us. It was handed down not to the son of the king, but to the nephew of the king. More specifically, it was handed to the king's sisters. And we don't really know why they had this system, but an Arab author had a suggestion that if he gave the crown to his own son, he couldn't actually know if his wife had cheated on him and he was actually giving the kingdom to someone else's son. But he could be sure that his sister, that her child was actually hers. There could be no foul play there. So that was one idea to why they had this system. The king and the majority of the Ghana kingdom were primarily animist, so they had a religion that focused on nature and the gods of nature to a large extent. But throughout the period, a lot of people also started to convert to Islam because there was a lot of trading relations across the Sahara with Islamic peoples, and a lot of the upper classes started to adopt the new religion. But not the king. So this increased the interaction that they had with the Arab world, as well as the Berbers, which had also been converted to Islam mainly. And the ruling class started to separate themselves, even physically, from the more animist class of peoples, as well as the king. So you had two cities in the capitals, one for the Muslims, who are the upper class advisors to the king, and one city for the other people as well as the king. So this interaction across the Sahara was a very, very prosperous trade that is often called the Trans-Saharan trade route, and there were a lot of caravans that traveled this route north to south from the coast of North Africa down through the Sahara to lower West Africa, where they traded resources, among others, gold, which was very central. And the capital of the kingdom was called Kumbi Sale. And the court of the king in Kumbi Sale was, it was described in very great detail by visitors, because it was a very rich kingdom, especially because of this gold trade I talked about. The gold was actually not at, in the area that was controlled by the empire, but it was on the same trade route. So the traders had to travel through the kingdom and had to pay taxes on the gold. And because of this great splendor of the court and of the capital, Ghana is sometimes known as the land of gold. And a large part of the wealth was very much centralized in the king, because the king had monopolized the gold trade. And the sort of social system below the king were, as I talked about before, dominated by Muslim upper class advisors to the king. And then below that you had the merchant class, which was sort of a middle class. And then you had your farmers, mine surveyors, and different types of craftsmen, who were not the lowest of the low, but sort of lower middle class, I would say. And then you had the slaves, which worked in households or in mines, for example. And the slave population was not very large compared to, for example, the transatlantic slave trade. But it was about the size the slave population was in Europe at the time. And it's also worth noting that the society worked kind of like in Europe at the time, in the medieval time, that even if you were a very rich trader, you weren't actually that upper class, because you needed to have noble birth in order to get access to that kind of upper class status. And the armies of Ghana were directly loyal to the king, and they were very professional and very well trained, and they were the main military force in the area. They were also made up of a corps of highly trained soldiers, and were bolstered by conscripts and slave soldiers in times of more large conflict. And while the king was of central importance to this setup, there were also a lot of minor sub-kings that were sort of vassal states. So they were controlled by the Ghana Empire, but they weren't actually part of the main kingdom. They had a sort of separate kingdoms that were controlled militarily by the Ouagadougou. And while the direct cause of Ghana's fall remains a mystery, by 1100 AD, the once prosperous kingdom was no more, and it was followed by the Islamic Empire of Mali. One of the main factors that people have talked about for years about why the Ghana fell is that the Almoravids, which was a Berber kingdom of Morocco mainly, that they invaded Ghana. But this claim remains very controversial, and there isn't really much archaeological evidence to support it. But the Almoravids claim this, but they were also known to exaggerate their conquests. So another explanation for the rapid decline is of environmental nature, because they lived in a very arid and very dry area where agriculture was very fragile. And since it was very fragile, when the weather changed and became even more dry, the land couldn't uphold the population anymore. There wasn't enough food to go around to everyone, especially when the Almoravids and the Berbers started to reclaim some of the land that the Ghana had conquered before. So this led to a very, very weak empire that couldn't control its vassals anymore. So one of the vassals rose up and rebelled, which led to the final destruction of the Ghana dynasty. And the empire that would take its place is called Mali, as I said. And it was around the same area of the actual country of Mali today, so that isn't as confusing. The empire was mainly Islamic, and it continued the very profitable trans-Sahara trade that the Ghana had pioneered. So after Ghana, basically all the rulers in this area adopt Islam wholesale. And one of the most notable rulers of Mali was called Mansa Musa, and he is known for his vast wealth, in large part due to the gold reserves of his kingdom. And there is even a story of when he went to the Hajj to Mecca, because he was a very devout Muslim. He brought a lot of gold, so much gold that every town he visited, the gold prices totally crashed, because he gave away so much gold, or traded in so much gold that the gold became almost useless. And that brings us to the end of what I actually had about Ghana, because I intended to make a whole episode about Ghana or Ouagadougou, but even with a university library at my disposal, I couldn't really find that much more. The sources kind of repeat themselves. And we don't really have that much about it, in part because they didn't really have the written sources that we have from other empires. And also because the empires that came after them may not have wanted them to be shown in the historical record. It's not really uncommon that when a new empire takes over an old empire, that they destroy the old empire's documents, and they want to sort of establish a new story of what the empire is and hide away the old. Especially since they didn't share religion, and the Mali Empire was mainly Muslim, and the Ghana Empire was animist, at least the ruling king. But I decided to add something else instead. Another kingdom in Africa that I find very interesting and that has persisted for a long time. And that country that I want to talk about today is called Ethiopia. So the area around what is today Ethiopia has a long history of organized kingdoms. Even in ancient Egyptian times, the area around northern Ethiopia was bordered by the prosperous Nubian kingdoms, who even invaded Egypt on several occasions and establishing their own pharaonic dynasties. However, the first state that we can link more directly to Ethiopia was called Aksum, and it crystallized around the time of the birth of Christ in what is today Eritrea and northern Ethiopia. The name Ethiopia is actually of Greek origin, and it was originally used by the Greeks to refer to any sub-Saharan Africans. So it was basically a catch-all name for just people who are dark-skinned. And I think the word actually literally means burned faces or something like that. The state was situated on the banks of the Red Sea, leading to excellent trade with the Arab kingdoms in the northeast, as well as the Nubian kingdoms in the west. And also the Roman Empire started to appear, also the Roman Empire in the north. And the prosperous trade that they had was in wares such as rhinoceros horns, ivory, and gold, and emeralds, but also slave trade. And the influences that came to this area through this trade with the various different partners led to different developments in Ethiopia that was unusual for the time, such as standardized coins, which was very uncommon outside, you know, large empires such as the Roman empires. It was uncommon in small kingdoms, but the king of Aksum decided to also standardize coins in order to facilitate the trade better. And the empire also accepted Christianity very early on, I'd only think that Roman Empire and Armenia had been Christianized before. And the specific tradition that was accepted was called Orthodox Christianity, and it's a special kind of Coptic Orthodox Christianity. And the acceptance of Christianity also led to the development of writing, because with Christianity came monks and monasteries, and they had to keep records, and they had to make sure that they write commentaries on the Bible and things like that. So they developed a system called Ges, which is the writing system used in Ethiopia even today. And this makes Ethiopia a lot easier to study for historians than neighboring peoples, because we have a lot of written sources to study. And monasteries in Ethiopia were very common, much like in Ireland. They started to crop up all over the place, and normal people had a lot of contact with these monasteries, which meant that their religion had a grounding in ordinary people, and not just in the monarchy. It wasn't just a decree from on high. It was a tradition that the everyday people also connected to. There are also a very beautiful tradition in Ethiopia of stone churches that are carved directly from the rock, especially in a town called Lalibela in Ethiopia. There are stone churches shaped like crosses that are like carved from the bare rock, like hollowed out. They're very beautiful. If you Google Lalibela churches, you should find them. And the adoption of Christianity also led to the abandonment of some other cultural practices that had existed before in Ethiopia, as well as the areas around Ethiopia, such as polygyny, which is the man marrying several wives. However, the king and the upper class still maintained polygyny, but it started to disappear among ordinary people. And the agriculture in Aksum was also more developed than in neighboring countries, and they tended to have more harvest and a more organized system of irrigation and things like that. The noble classes of Ethiopia were warriors, much like the noble classes in Europe started out being, you know, the knights, the horse warriors. And in order to maintain the loyalty of these noble warriors, the king basically expanded all the time. So there were more or less constant wars to enlarge the realm. There is a very unique tradition of stories around the foundation of Ethiopia that is very deeply connected to the Christian and also Jewish tradition of Ethiopia, because there is a Jewish society in Ethiopia that has been there for a long time. And in the national epos called Kebra Nagast, which was written in around 1300 AD, tells the story of the Queen of Sheba, which they think is Ethiopia. It may have been Ethiopia, it may also have been Yemen, we don't really know. But she visited King Solomon to seek his wisdom, since she was an inexperienced ruler. And there she supposedly learned Jewish statecraft and converted to Judaism. And some of this is in the Bible. It's a very short story in the Bible. But the Ethiopian tradition doesn't stop there. They also say that Solomon impregnated the Queen of Sheba, who then gave birth to a son called Menelik, which was the first king of the kingdom of Aksum. So the Ethiopian line of succession is supposedly derived from King Solomon. And when visiting his father in grown age, Menelik brought with him the Ark of the Covenant without the approval of the king, so he basically stole it back to Ethiopia. And there also followed a number of Jews down to Ethiopia with him. And this is sort of a connection to the Ethiopian Jewish society that still exists today, even if most of them have moved to Israel by now. There still exists a small society called Bene Israel. This story places Ethiopia as the inheritors of basically the Israeli or Hebrew tradition. So they see themselves kind of like a second Israel. And the royal line is also called the Solomonic line. So this very much ties in the monarchy with the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. And although this is a very powerful national myth, it isn't really that historically accurate, what we can tell. The story was written 2,000 years after the purported events, so you can't really view it as a historically accurate document. It's more legend or mythos. But another consequence of this idea of Ethiopia being founded from the House of Israel is that the Ethiopian church tend to focus more on the Old Testament rather than the New Testament, and they talk more about Yahweh than they talk about Jesus, for example. So there are some elements of Judaism still in the religion. For example, they still keep the dietary laws of the Old Testament, which Christianity has largely abandoned. And a large change came to Aksum with the advent of Islam, leading to attacks on their trading partners, as well as their own kingdoms. While some people converted, other moved up high in the mountains. And there was strong resistance to this new religion among a lot of people, because there was a very strong adherence to Orthodox Christianity, because it had also been very much tied into what it was to be an Ethiopian, as I mentioned before. And during the European Middle Ages, a rumor started flourishing in the different Christian kingdoms that had been established after the Crusades, that there was a man called Prester John that had a Christian kingdom somewhere. They didn't really know at all where that was. They argued that it might be the Mongols that was Prester John, but most likely what they were referring to was Ethiopia. And they sent out a bunch of expeditions to find this mythic king, Prester John. And later on, in the 1500s, they made contact with the Ethiopians, and they claimed that this was how they finally had found Prester John. And they even gave the Ethiopians some military aid. The Portuguese, for example, said sent a few hundred sailors to fight off an attack from Adal, which was a sultanate in what is today Somalia. And the Portuguese, with the customary humility of a European colonial power, decided that the Ethiopians believed in the wrong kind of Christianity and they needed to be converted into Roman Catholicism. But as we mentioned before, the Ethiopians were pretty staunchly Orthodox, and they had no real desire to change religion from their very old type of Christianity into a much newer kind that they didn't really relate to. So the missionaries were kicked out pretty soon. And Ethiopia remained very independent. Even throughout the scramble for Africa, Ethiopia even managed to not be conquered. And they inflicted a massive defeat to Italy. They tried to conquer them in the 1890s at what is known as the Battle of Adwa, which is the largest military defeat by any colonial power against an indigenous people. But when Mussolini came to power, he turned the Italian Air Force on the Ethiopian population using chemical weapons, and the Ethiopian government could not withstand, and the state was occupied. And this was actually one of the first failures of the League of Nations, because the League of Nations was supposed to stop this, because Ethiopia was a member, and Italy was, you know, against all laws of war to use chemical weapons, for example. So ideally, the League of Nations should have stopped this, but they didn't. And the walkover of Ethiopia is one in the line of sort of the Allied powers caving in and not doing things when Germany and Italy decided to expand. But after World War II, Ethiopia was re-established again. And the state remains even today, even if it is no longer a kingdom. So that was pretty much everything I had for today. I hope you find this little bit of African history interesting. It's been very interesting to write. I thought that I would also bring up Ethiopia because it's maybe a little easier to find sources on it. But it also has a very unique tradition because of its early adoption of Christianity and things like that. So if you want to read more about these kingdoms, it's actually quite hard to find sources. There are some general books on African history that you can find, a book called A History of Sub-Saharan Africa, as well as African History, A Very Short Introduction. Could have some useful information, or you could just use what I used, which is A History of World Societies, which is a very heavy university course book about world history, but there is a lot of information in there as well. So thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and please give a comment, give some feedback, like, share, subscribe, all the things. And I'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.